In the Golden Age, amateur astronomer Ted Knight developed a device that harnessed stellar energy. He used that device, eventually dubbed a cosmic rod, to battle crime in Opal City and beyond as Starman. Decades later, an aged Ted handed the mantle to his eldest son David, who was murdered shortly thereafter. It then fell upon the youngest son, Jack Knight, to take up the rod and forge his own destiny as his own brand of Starman.
Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 55 of Supermates, a husband and wife geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
This episode we're going to be covering part 5 of our Starman Chronicles series, covering the James Robinson, Tony Harris Starman comic from the 90s. But before we get into that, credit where credit is due, department. Last episode, I failed to credit back issue editor Michael Urie for his Justice League companion book. That is where I read the info on Snapper Carr, the behind-the-scenes secret origin of Snapper Carr. We mentioned Michael during the Snapper segment, but I somehow forgot to plug the book, which is a crime because if you are a fan of the classic JLA, you need that book. That's one of the best Tomorrow's Companion books out there, and that's saying something because they're all awesome. Unfortunately, it's out of print, but I'm sure you can find a copy on eBay or something, or maybe Amazon still has a copy, but I know Tomorrow's is out. I looked, because sometimes they'll have a digital copy.
Right.
But it's like gone completely. But seek it out. It's a fantastic book. But we're going to jump into, as I said, coverage of Starman again. So we're back to Opal City. And the issues that we're covering this time are a really great snapshot of the series because you get a breather issue after the major storyline, Sins of the Child, last time. So the breather issue is number 17. That's a great jumping on point if you hadn't been reading the series, but it also moves the characters forward. Then you have a Times Past issue with number 18, which spotlights Ted Knight. And then there's the annual Talking with David issue in number 19, which is, of course, one of the things best remembered about that series. So, and also, thanks to our pal Rob Kelly, we're going to cover the two-part Shade Dr. Fate story from Showcase 96, number 4 and 5. And the Shade referenced this story a few issues back, and actually, until we started doing this, I didn't even realize that that story existed. I thought it was just an arbitrary reference because the Shade makes lots of references to things
right. You
never see. But they actually printed this one, so I didn't have these issues. So thanks to Rob for the help there. And speaking of the Shade, our other fire and water landlord, the Irredeemable Shag, very generously sent us the 4-issue Shade miniseries from 1997. So we'll be covering that when we hit it in the chronology. So thanks to Rob and Shag for helping us out. It just so happened that they both helped us out right around the same time, which was cool. And also, before we forget, I'm going to mention another Fire and Water Network pal, Ryan Daly. Sorry, Siskoid, I don't have nothing on you here this time, buddy. But Ryan Daly recently covered Marvel's Star Wars C-3PO one-shot comic that came out not too long ago, which answers the most important question left unanswered by The Force Awakens. No, not who Rey really is. The other one. Where did C-3PO get that red arm?
Oh, well, you know.
Yeah. So what does that have to do with Starman? Well, surprisingly, that comic was written by James Robinson and drawn by Tony Harris. And I got it, and I have not read it yet, but it looks great, and I have listened to Ryan's episode, which is a fantastic episode to give me those Star Wars. So check that out. But yes, Robinson and Harris have reunited on a Star Wars comic. So if you can find that one, go get it. Okay, so now we will jump into our Starman coverage proper with Starman number 17, cover dated March 1996, on sale January 16th, 1996. So that was just about a week or so after we got married.
So when you became the luckiest man on the planet.
Yes, exactly. Well, I already was the luckiest man on the planet because I was with you even before we were married.
Ooh, slick.
Smooth.
Mm-hmm.
This cover painting by Tony Harris, of course, shows Charity, the fortune teller, friend of Jack's, holding her cat, reading tarot cards featuring the book's cast. Jack is the star. Surprisingly not. Yeah, not surprising. Macau is on the temperance card. Grundy is the fool. Ted is the hermit. Shade is the magician. Matt O'Dare is the hanged man. And his older brother, Clarence, is justice. The cover copy reads, Beyond Sins, obviously making it a epilogue to Sins of the Child. But the actual title is Encounters. Writer, James Robinson. Penciler, Tony Harris. Inker, Wade Von Graubadger. Von Graubadger. Colorist, Gregory Wright. Letterer, Bill Oakley. Editor, Archie Goodwin. Assistant editor, Chuck Kim.
In the prologue, we witness two of the Miss Men continuing her night of carnage past its deadline. One of the men, Ralph, has killed an aged Chinese grocer over a stolen pack of cigarettes. His partner protests as the murderer grabs the grocer's granddaughter and attempts to kidnap her at gunpoint. They are stopped by the sudden appearance of a ghostly pirate, who quickly and fatally dispatches them. The woman is afraid at first, but the pirate assures her that she has no need to fear him. He identifies himself as John Valor, British nobleman, and the privateer once known as the Black Pirate.
In his apartment, Jack lays with his on-again, off-again girlfriend, Lucy. Lucy gets out of Jack's bed and says the three words every man fears, "We gotta talk."
Dun, dun, dun.
As Lucy gets dressed, she tells Jack she is leaving, this time for good. That their brief reunion last night was a mistake. She reminds Jack of how he left her for a stripper last time, and how he was probably just feeling vulnerable and lonely last night. Jack swears he's changed. He's responsible. He's a superhero. Lucy comments that his heroism doesn't make him a nice person. He tells him of the art firm job she's taking in Midway City, far from the Opal. With nothing he can say to change her mind, Jack wishes Lucy luck, and she walks out the door.
At Meskin Medical Hospital, Ted Knight ponders what to do about the injured Solomon Grundy. He can't believe this gentle creature was once the foe of his team, the Justice Society. That this white giant was the same monster that inadvertently caused the death of his friend and teammate, Sylvester Pemberton, the Star-Spangled Kid, who once welded the cosmic rod. Who used Ted's technology to later become Skyman. Ted remembers how Sylvester almost picked the name Starman. He was almost another who bore the name Ted created.
Ted notes how different Grundy is from the one he best remembers, how he is even different than the savage version Batman recently fought. He theorizes that Grundy may be reborn anew each time he rises again from the swamp with a new personality and only vague memories of his past life. Ted wonders if he can hold this creature responsible for his friend's death. Should he hate him as an enemy or love him like an innocent child? Unknown to Ted, Grundy hears this and cries.
Later, a hospital doctor fills Ted in on the progress of the other charge Jack brought to his home, Michael Thomas, a.k.a. the alien Starman. Not only has Michael's condition improved, he has radically changed in other ways. Ted is stunned to enter Michael's room and have him greet him in English.
Jack pays a professional call to his fortune teller friend Charity. Jack recognizes a portrait on her wall as John Zatara, the famous magician hero. Charity tells him he's an old dear friend. She tells Jack he's close to going into outer space because his father did and because someone will ask him that he can't refuse. The wingman she told him of before may never come, and he's off on another path. He will, however, meet they of the thunder and the lightning and a man with a heart like a cool green field.
Jack asks if being Starman will get him killed. Charity answers he will come to two crossroads. Taking the wrong turn either time will end in his death. She does tell Jack he will know peace when he holds his son's hand. She also tells him to listen to his thoughts, that he has her abilities, but on a smaller scale.
Their session over, Jack asks Charity out on a date, but she politely declines as her destiny lies with another man she will meet. He does convince her to go to dinner and a movie with him, just as friends.
Across town, the Shade makes a deal with four of the O'Dares, Hope, Matt, Mason, and Barry. If they help him now, he will offer them aid whenever they need it. The Shade seeks their help in stopping his immortal foe, Damon Merritt, and his demonic poster. As they prepare for their mission, the family informs Shade that Brother Clarence was not informed of this dangerous mission, so one may live to carry on the family name. Plus, they're all afraid of Clarence's wife.
Later, Jack discusses his potential new shop with his barber while getting a haircut. He first noticed the shop right before the Mist Men abducted him. He can't lease the building due to insurance refusing to cover his dangerous occupation, but he may be able to buy it if he can secure the funds. As he walks from the barbershop, Jack bumps into Sadie Falk once more. This time their meeting is slightly friendlier than their previous encounters.
At Opal City Hall, Clarence O'Dare meets with new police commissioner Wu. Wu discusses how other cities have dealt with costume vigilantes. Some discourage their activities, but he has heard rumors that Jim Gordon had an arrangement with Batman in Gotham. He asks how Clarence thinks they should handle Jack Knight. Clarence advocates working with him, just as his father and Red Bailey worked with Ted Knight for years. Wu agrees and names Clarence as Starman's official liaison with the police.
Meanwhile, Clarence's siblings are knee-deep in battle with Merritt's hired goons and a horde of demons he has let loose. While Merritt flees, Shade and Matt O'Dare battle the unholy army with shadow powers and six guns. The poster demon flees back into his world as well, but the resultant vortex sucks Matt O'Dare inside. As he struggles against the singularity, Matt asks the Shade to make sure his family name stays clean, despite his previous illegal activities. Shade asks why the sudden change of heart, and is shocked to learn Matt is the reincarnation of his old friend, Brian Savage, the Western hero known as Scalp Hunter. O'Dare disappears into the poster portal, and the Shade ponders what to do next. What he decides surprises even him as he leaps headlong into the vortex.
The poster now shows an image of a demon torturing Matt and the Shade with the inscription, Two Fools.
Yes, yes. Now, this is another great cover. Of course, it's by Tony Harris, so it's a great cover. And the idea of the characters being on the tarot cards is a nice touch, especially given the scene with Charity inside. So, it's, you know, it's a nice little touch there. Man, I'm glad the Black Pirate took out the Mist Men.
Yeah.
What scumbags, you know? It's just, whew. Now, I knew the Black Pirate from a Whatever Happened To story in DC Comics Presents. They did a, you know, Whatever Happened to the Black Pirate.
Oh, okay.
He was actually a Golden Age character, but mm-hmm. he was set, you know, in pirate times. Who's Who and a time travel adventure from the Crisis issues of All-Star Squadron also featured him. So he never looked so authentically pirate-like before. He was more of a high sea Zorro in the original comics. He had a cowl and a cape and, yeah. It was kind of shocking to see Jack in bed with anyone, let alone an African-American lady in the mid-90s. I mean,
you just
didn't see that back then, especially, I mean, this wasn't a code-approved book, but, you know, again, you just didn't see, outside the Vertigo titles, DC titles, you didn't see that type of stuff, but, you know. Now, Lucy reminds us that despite following Jack's heroic adventures, he can be and was kind of a dick before taking up the Starman mantle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, very self-centered and selfish.
Yeah. So, you know, it's after all we've gone through, Jack, you know, Robinson wants to remind us, hey, he's not all, you know, Lily White. And, you know, he's not the paragon of virtue that other comic characters might be. Now, I don't think we ever see Lucy again, but I could be wrong because, again, I'm rereading this as we go. I'm not reading ahead. So, I honestly think it works better if we don't see her again,
mm-hmm.
because she seems like she deserves better than Jack.
Or at least how Jack is at this point.
At this point, exactly. The Jack she knew, she deserves better, so mm-hmm. good for her. Good, go Lucy, go. Go to Midway City. And just stay clear of the Doom Patrol and Hawkman. So, hey, they're in Midway City. You gotta always point out the collectible stuff Jack has in his either apartment or shop or whatever. Jack has a Howdy Doody puppet and a Slinky counter display on his bed headboard shelf. So, but yeah, that thing moves around a lot.
Christopher.
Rolls downstairs, alone or in pairs. Rolls over your neighbor's dog.
Rolls over something else?
What's great for a snack and fits on your back. It's log, log, log.
You completely confused two different things.
I know. Well, okay. That's what it was based on.
I know.
That's what log was based on. Okay. When Ted's thinking about Grundy, we get a panel of Sylvester Pemberton as a Star-Spangled Kid holding the cosmic rod, and Grundy taking Mr. Bone's cyanide hand and touching Skyman's face, which is how he died.
Mm.
I believe that Grundy was under the influence of the evil Harlequin, who was like, she was the new version of Green Lantern's old foe, the Harlequin, who he ends up marrying, Alan Scott.
Uh-huh.
And she was like impersonating Jade, which Grundy followed whatever Jade told him, And I think that's what happened. I didn't read those Infinity issues, but I got the All-Star Companions and things. So I think that happened toward the end of Infinity Incorporated when Roy Thomas was, you know, saying, screw it, I'm not doing this book. I'm taking some of these characters out with me. So Grundy's recent battle with Batman happened a few months earlier in Batman Shadow of the Bat number 39 from June 1995.
Okay.
And Grundy looked really weird in that issue. I remember he was like all huge in his upper torso, and then he looked like he had like skeletal hips. It was really strange. It was really, really weird. Needless to say, Mikal or Michael and Grundy's storyline go in different directions from this point. So I don't want to get too deep into what Charity told Jack, as we'll see those developments as the series progresses. However, the Winged Man is obviously Hawkman.
Well, yeah.
Who was only 4 issues away from cancellation. So I'm guessing they had a crossover planned, and because it's getting canceled, they're wrapping the book up, they scrapped those plans.
Right,
because,
and that way it was just a throwaway line to take care of that.
Right, because she had mentioned the Winged Man the first time they met in the very first storyline. So, in fact, after that series of Hawkman, DC forbade any writer to use the character or that name for years, even Grant Morrison. So, you know, because he wanted to make Zariel in JLA the new Hawkman, and they wouldn't let him. Yeah. I love Jack's discussion about Charity saving herself on page 12, panel 4. Charity says,
no, I'm sorry, really. You're not the one for me, Jack, even in the most casual manner. I'm saving myself.
Until marriage?
Nothing like that, no. Back home, there were many the cab of a pickup truck that knew my feet against its windshield.
I like that. I mean, Charity comes across as this otherworldly, you know, mystical Madame Xanadu type character. And yeah, but now she was, you know, she's making out in pickup trucks. See, now that's adding character, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's making this character that could be very inhuman and this, you know, oracle of prophecy and portent and making her like, you know, she was just some loose girl that made out in pickup trucks.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
and apparently with many different ones.
Yeah, man. Exactly. That's why I said loose. Yeah. Speaking of kind of funny little bits, it's hilarious to think that the O'Dare clan is afraid of their sister-in-law if they get Clarence hurt.
Yep.
Yeah. Because he's the only one of the bunch that's married.
Yeah. And I mean,
yeah.
But you got to think, you know, it would take a strong woman to marry into that clan.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, especially, she'd have to be a kick butt, take no names kind of person.
Yeah, she would. She definitely would, because I mean, they've got like they're born into their occupation essentially.
Yeah,
and you know, there's even if they're not necessarily good people, they're still cops. You know, and we see as they change and evolve. But yeah, so now we know what Jack saw right before the Mist Men grabbed him. I know you and me pointed out, what the crap was he looking at?
Yeah.
Because Robinson didn't tell us. And the artwork was vague,
mm-hmm.
and I was worried that they would never, we were like, did they ever tell us? I couldn't remember that it was the shop.
Right.
So he saw the shop that he
wanted. And why? Why not tell? I mean, to me, that was just kind of, you know, oh, here's something that you can't see, but there's really no reason not to tell us.
Even if he'd said, like, that building, whoa, that, you know, and then they abducted him.
Yeah.
So we'd know, well, it's a building, but what's it for?
Yeah.
But to me, it was like a huge, because you and me talked about it for like 5 minutes trying to figure out what the crappy earth they ever addressed it.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. Robinson clearly isn't buying the Bat Office's ridiculous edict that Batman is an urban legend that was, you know, they were pushing at the time. Wu knows there is a Batman, and he is even pretty certain that Jim Gordon works with him. You know, that giant flashlight on top of the building might be a clue. I don't know.
Yeah, it might clue in, you know. I kind of like how Robinson's like, yeah, I work for DC, but you know what? This is the way I see the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm surprised he got away with it. Good for him. But, you know, you could kind of tell he was kind of, meh.
Well, I don't think it's spoiling too far, too much ahead. It's at one point we see Batman in the series, and he really takes a whack at the way some writers portrayed Batman at the time, which is, it's him and Jack have some interesting interactions. I'm looking forward to getting to that. We are told we'll get more details of how the Shade and the O'Dares made their way into Merritt's lair later. That's actually going to be down the road quite a bit. we got another storyline before we get to that.
Because, I mean, they show us this, and then they backpedal and show,
Yeah, more of it, which they do that sometimes.
Oh, here. I know.
So now the Shade knows that Matt O'Dare is his reincarnated friend, the Scalp Hunter. Robinson, who is the heir to Roy Thomas in more ways than one, ties the old characters Matt Savage, Trail Boss, Scalp Hunter, and Balloon Buster together. Brian Savage, the Scalp Hunter, is the son of Western character Matt Savage and the father of Steve Savage, the World War I pilot known as the Balloon Buster.
Anybody else's head hurt now?
They were all named Savage, and so there you go.
Makes my head hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. The Shade actually does a pretty heroic thing here, and he notes it. He's going in after his friend. He notes how strange it is that he's being just completely altruistic and jumping in. Now, there is an entry from the Shade's journal at the back of the book, and to say it's rambling is an understatement, but that seems to be the point. The Shade writes of how he didn't care for any animals in his previous life, that he has learned to love dogs, although he won't have one since their lifespans are too short, and he, of course, is immortal.
Right.
This segues into discussion of the people he has killed, one being Hollywood mogul Louis B. Mayer, which is interesting. He even mentions biographer and former superhero Jonathan Law, a.k.a. the Tarantula. Realizing the schizophrenic nature of his entry, the Shade then begins telling of the time in 1943 when he was approached by a group of armed men whom he promptly killed. Turns out those men were only sent to offer him a job for his services. Their employer was none other than Howard Hughes, and the genius billionaire needed help in stopping a succession of magical assassins, including a griffin and a giant white rabbit, that were out to kill him, to be continued.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So there you go. So we got any more on this one?
Nope. Next issue.
Okay, next issue. Okay, we're going to jump into Starman number 18, April 1996, on sale February 20th, 1996, according to Mike's Amazing World. This cover painting by Harris shows a young Ted Knight dressed as Starman holding his cosmic rod and floating above the abyss under a railroad bridge or trestle. In his other hand, he holds the wrist of the Mist, who is also much younger than we remember. The cover reads, "Times Past, Starman, the Mist, First Joust." And the name of the story is actually First Joust in the comic. James Robinson, writer. John Watkiss, artist. Gregory Wright, colorist. Oakley, NJQ, letterers. I don't know what the crap that means. Archie Goodwin, editor. Chuck Kim, assistant editor.
The Shade writes in his journal, he describes the time of year during World War II. It was autumn. He had begun to make sport with his rival, Jay Garrick, the Flash, but he had served his home country by returning to England and aiding aviator hero Captain X against the Nazi threat. Meanwhile, Ted Knight continued his new career as Starman and first tangled with his arch foe.
At a posh nightclub, Starman and Police Captain Red Bailey look at the carnage left in the wake of a strange robbery. Hundreds of unconscious partygoers and 11 dead ones who drank brandy in addition to inhaling the sleeping gas released into the room. Bailey informed Starman of the head criminal's appearance, a swirling body of gas with only visible head and arms. He is known as the Mist.
Although he and his gang looted the room, the Mist showed some amount of honor when he murdered one of his own henchmen who attempted to take advantage of an unconscious woman. Starman is surprised to find Bailey so cooperative, but the captain points out that he is a forward thinker, and others may not be so understanding. Before he takes off, Bailey asks the young hero if he was born and raised in Opal. When Starman answers in the affirmative, Bailey believes he'll do just fine.
In his lair, while his men sort their loot, the Mist wonders out loud if this is what his wife will be like. He thought perhaps his scientific genius or his valor in the Great War would bring him fame, but now he feels he'll be famous as one of the first of a new breed of criminal. He says aloud, "I'm a villain." Gloating over his ill-gotten gains, it's the first time the thought truly occurred to him.
Later, the Mist and his men hid in Opal City Bank in similar fashion, but Starman arrives smartly wearing a gas mask and quickly mows through the Mist hired help. But he is stopped when the villain holds a woman at knifepoint. To save the woman's life, Starman removes his gas mask and succumbs to the gas.
The Shade notes that the Mist could have killed Starman that day. Their arch rivalry, which spanned decades, could have ended before it began. Yet the Mist spared his foe. Why? The Shade has no idea. Starman awoke with the other victims, and the Mist was gone.
Later, a groggy Starman confers with Red Bailey in his office. The Astral Avenger tells of how he got a tip about the bank from a stoolie. He also caught mention of a name, Wilson May. Bailey agrees to look into the lead and tells Starman that only one person at the bank died, a customer named Victor Ross, who was fond of brandy.
The Shade interrupts his tale to describe Ted Knight as a thinking man's hero, one who slowly became more and more adept at detective work, not unlike his fellow JSA-er, Sandman. But he notes Ted was no stranger to physical confrontations, either. Starman tears through the underworld looking for answers. He follows the clues across Opal from one person to another. He asks a Dr. Delaney about Victor Ross. He visits an art gallery where the owner, Dooney, discusses the popular work of artist Wilson May. He visits the newspaper offices of a man named Mayhew for info on the Opal art scene. Who loves who and who hates who? And then, pondering on a rooftop, it comes to him. He questions yet another man who tells him the Mist is leaving town for Keystone City via train that very night.
In his train car, the Mist spies Starman approaching. He frantically makes his way through the many cars to the engine, where he demands the conductor speed up. He slashes the fireman, and suddenly there's no one to quicken the pace. Suddenly, Starman appears, and the desperate Mist briefly takes the conductor at knife point before leaping from the train as it travels along a trestle over a large ravine.
As he apparently leaps to his death, the Mist yells that he won't be saved or caught. His body assumes its gaseous form, but Starman grabs his human hand. The Mist asks why he saved him, and Starman inquires why he was spared back at the bank. The Mist tells him it seemed unfair to kill him while he was helpless. Starman answers that heroes don't let their enemies die. The Mist asks, and villains do? He will remember that for the next time.
The next night, Starman gathers five men in Dooney's apartment. All were involved in helping solve the case in some way. Dooney himself, the art gallery owner, Mayhew the newspaper man, Delaney the doctor, Red Bailey the police captain, and artist Wilson May. The Rod Ranger explains it was May who was the unwitting cause of the whole affair. Victor Ross had been May's manager for years. He controlled May's skyrocketing career. But another man, Collett Boyle, wanted a piece of that action. When Ross told Dooney that May was too big of an artist for his gallery, Dooney asked Boyle to step in to try and persuade the artist otherwise. He went one step beyond and hired the Mist to murder Ross using his crime spree as a cover while turning an even tidier profit. The gas Mist developed specifically targeted Ross as its chemicals mixed with his favorite brandy, creating a toxic solution.
Starman then offers the men quite an exciting expedition, a chance to visit the Mist's secret scientific lair and stare at its wonders. They all take him up on the offer, and the six men venture to the cavern headquarters.
Shade writes that that innocent little trip will eventually lead to the deaths of every man except for Ted Knight. 50 years later, the Mist daughter would systematically kill each of those men under the cover of a rampant crime spree. This first meeting would resonate across the decade.
Now, this issue had me at hello because, you know, it had Ted Knight as Starman on the cover, and I love the cover. And if you notice, just throughout the series, Harris likes to play around with Ted's outfit. He tinkers with design elements here and there, and it gives us the notion that he had multiple costumes, because here he's got flounced Captain America-like boots,
right?
Which he normally doesn't. He usually has Superman boots.
Well, you have to think, I mean, Ted Knight is a scientist, so he's always changing and growing, and I mean, so he's going to be experimenting about what works best. I mean, it just makes sense that he wouldn't just have one suit and that be it.
Right, yeah. Now, is it just me, or does Ted look like a young Bud Abbott on that cover? Can you see that?
Okay.
You don't see that?
Okay.
Okay, I think he does.
Oh, that's fair enough.
Okay. Artist John Wadkiss had just finished a Legends of the Dark Knight arc with James Robson called Werewolf when he drew this issue. So, Shade mentions Captain X. That was a really obscure DC character that had been revived a few years before and tied into Firestorm. I believe he was made, it was revealed that he was Ronnie Raymond's grandfather.
Really?
So, yeah. So, there you go, Shag. Firestorm reference. Thankfully, Shade calls the Flash J. Garrick, I-C-K, because several times in this series he's called J. Garrett, E-T-T at the end, which drives me nuts.
Uh-huh.
And they call Alan Scott, instead of A-L-A-N, it's A-L-L-E-N, like Barry Allen.
Right.
Which is just, I can't decide if I like Watkus's art or not. I don't like how he draws where Ted's cape meets the star on his chest, and some panels are really sketchy, and they look just like thumbnails, really, honestly. But in other panels, I really like what he did. It's like, it's really, it's pretty inconsistent.
Uneven. Yeah,
it's inconsistent, yeah. Now, Robinson is painting a complex picture of the Mist. He's a murderer, but he won't allow a woman to be raped.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not making him a hero like some writers, Jeff Johns, but he's giving him dimension. You know, there's some things he's just not going to go along with, and that's one of them.
Honor among thieves.
Right, yep. The bit where Red Bailey is obviously, you know, being juxtaposed with Clarence O'Dare's new position as Jack's liaison is a nice touch. You know, mm-hmm. we just read that, and, you know, we're reading how Ted first started to work with the police department in Opal City. Now, the bit where the Mist realizes he's a villain, that was an interesting touch. I don't think I've ever read that in a comic or anywhere where the guy's like, huh, I'm the villain. You know, it just occurred to him all of a sudden, you know, because this was not his plan, you know, and it just, that's where he went, so. Now, Watkus fudges the period setting here and there in the art. Starman's gas mask is way too futuristic looking, mm-hmm. even for a guy with a cosmic rod. And the train we see later, I don't think it's ever existed in any reality we know of.
Right.
So, you know, I can't give this guy a pass because we butchered the DC Bombshells, some of the artists for, you know, not, you know,
Doing their homework.
And I mean, I'm not saying that they couldn't be advanced stuff, you know, in this period because it's superhero comics and things, but the train should have looked like a normal train. The gas mask I can kind of give you, but...
But by the same token, we don't say anything. I mean, this is me playing devil's advocate, but in the Bruce Timm universe, they have the 1940s era cars and clothing mixed in with the computers and stuff, and we don't say anything about that.
Yeah, but that's a choice. That's a choice in its own universe. This is set in the DC universe where there were comic books published in the 1940s and everything looks like stuff in the 1940s, like trains and cars, you know. So,
I disagree, but that's okay.
Okay. Now, at the bank, the Mist grabs this woman by knife point.
Mm-hmm.
She's drawn as being conscious. Why is she conscious?
Yes.
She's struggling.
Everybody else is out.
Everybody else is knocked out that doesn't have a gas mask. Why would she be conscious?
Mm-hmm.
That was a big mistake. I mean, I think the artist should have just drawn her unconscious and it would have been fine because he still could have killed her.
Right.
While she was unconscious, obviously. And speaking of killing, I bet Mist really regrets not killing Ted. What do you think?
But it's kind of one of those things, I mean, by Ted saying heroes save their foes. I mean, he's setting the parameters for their relationship throughout the rest of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one of those things. You're a villain, so this is how you're supposed to act. And he, you know, so he kind of sets himself up for the whole fall.
Yeah.
Anyway, instead of saying, you know, why didn't he try and reach him? Why didn't he try and say, why are you doing this? Why, you know, instead right. of just automatically, hey, let's have a fight and this is how you're supposed to act.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
there's that to say.
I don't think he realized that, maybe he didn't realize the Mist was in this kind of questioning state of, am I really the villain? I'm the villain. And, you know, he didn't realize he was in this embryonic state that he could go in a different direction if he talked to him. He was just another bad guy to, you know, round up, and he didn't know he would end up being his arch enemy, you know. So, but I see your point. If he had talked to him, he might have avoided a lot of trouble later.
Mm-hmm.
Well, David wouldn't be dead for one, so.
Right. He might not have ended up being such a lethal arch-villain.
Right, that's true. Shade mentions old DC detectives like the super obscure Sierra Smith, who didn't even write a Who's Who entry. That's how obscure he is. And Roy Raymond, TV detective, but who had a strip. So, why didn't the Mist just turn ethereal and leave the train when he saw Ted approaching before they were on the trestle?
It's what was in the script.
Okay. The mystery angle is an odd one. Now, we the readers aren't given enough clues to solve it.
Mm-mm.
So, we gloss over parts of it, and the only info dump reveals that Miss True Motives and the connections to Brandy, Ross, Wilson, May, etc. I mean, that's all, it's all just a huge info dump at the end. Which, I mean, I don't guess that was, it wasn't the point that we were supposed to solve it. But
it would have been a nice touch if they'd even shown the fellow that was supposed to like the brandy so much, show him in a panel with that brandy.
Right.
You
yeah.
know.
Yeah, exactly.
With the canner over there, you know, something.
Yeah.
That would have, just even that would have been a nice nod to it.
Yeah. Now, this ending reminds me, I just watched The Maltese Falcon the other day. It kind of fits that period, you know, because there's all these characters coming together who you're not even sure how they're all related at first, and then all of a sudden you're through a lot of dialogue, you're told it kind of contradicts the show don't tell, which is, you know, that's one of the big mantras of writers, show don't tell. But that story violates it, and everyone loves it. It's classic, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one kind of does too, you know. So it kind of fits in with that film noir kind of thing. There's no femme fatale in it. That's the only, you know, non-noirish thing in it. But it does kind of fit into that time period, which this is the time period that movie came out.
So. Right.
Of course, this ties into Sins of the Child and fills in the story of Nash missed told Jack at the story's end about how she was searching for her father's medal. She killed all those people that mm-hmm. were there because her father's medal went missing after those men went into his headquarters.
Yeah, his lair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm a sucker for any Ted-centric issue of the series, but the story isn't quite as epic as one might expect, although maybe that's kind of Robinson's point. The humble beginnings
right.
of this epic arch rivalry, you know, that would stretch out for 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, not every hero is going to have movie-worthy beginnings.
Right, yeah, yeah. So with that, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll jump into Showcase 96, number 4 and 5.
Warlord Worlds, a fan podcast devoted to the comic creations of Mike Grell, including Warlord, John Sable, Starslayer, Shaman's Tears, and Green Arrow. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. You'll join us as we discuss the stories, characters, and art in the many excellent comics from writer and artist Mike Grell.
Warlord Worlds is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Find us at warlordworlds.com.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to cover, as I said, Showcase 96, number 4. From April 1996, on sale February 20th, 1996, DC had revived their venerable Showcase title as a 12-issue anthology miniseries in late 1992. Each year, they'd rename the series with that new year. The first 2 years cover featured Batman-related characters. The last year focused on the Superman family. Inside were random stories of characters throughout the DCU, most of which tied into ongoing series in some ways. The series ran for 4 years, this being the last. So the last 2 years were Superman-related characters. The cover by Lee Weeks doesn't really matter to us, as it features the Guardian, as in Guardian and the Newsboy Legion, and the Blink and You'll Forget Him revival of Firebrand, who had an ongoing series for about 2 minutes and then was killed off ingloriously in JSA a few years later. I really like the Guardian, though. I've always liked the Guardian, but... So, Day and Night, Night and Bright, Part 1, James Robinson, writer, Matt Smith, no, not that Matt Smith, art, Melissa Edwards, colorist.
Oh, you were trying to do Doctor Who.
Yeah, I was trying to do Doctor Who.
Oh, I couldn't figure out what you were trying to do. Okay, that was really bad.
Dun, 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 I'm sorry. Melissa Edwards, colorist, Christopher P. Elopoulos, sorry, I don't even know. I didn't write down what he did. I guess he was a letterer. Sorry. Chuck Kim, editor.
Like many other stories, this one begins with the Shade in his study, logging an entry into his journal. He is more introspective than usual, citing that these events began the change in him from completely dark to a lighter shade of gray. He thinks often of the hero he met on this adventure, but first he must discuss two other heroes.
He was battling Flash's Jay Garrick and Barry Allen with a ridiculous shadow construct made to look like a giant robot. Jay notes that he could have ripped them apart at any time, but there was no sport in that. Besides, his role as supervillain covered up his true motives and missions. He did suspect that perhaps as his oldest superhero foe, Jay knew of the Shade's real nature, but that he too decided to just play along. Before the Scarlet Speedsters can move in to end the charade, Shade disappears into a portal that comes up beneath him. The Speedsters are left to ponder what happened to their foe, and he himself wonders the same thing as he finds himself in darkness.
That darkness is soon shattered by a glowing yellow light. Before the Shade floats Dr. Fate, who tells him he means him no harm. Of course, the Shade wants to know why he has been brought to Fate's Tower in Salem. Fate then tells him what he has gleaned of the Shade's origins, from obscure writings across the globe. How the Shade gained his shadow powers and immortality on the night 104 souls were lost. One of those texts was written by none other than the Shade's old friend, Charles Dickens. Shade thought Dickens had destroyed the unfinished manuscript when he chose to focus on different characters he had met that fateful night. Shade notes the effects of that night no doubt contributed to Dickens's early death.
Fate confides that Shade isn't quite a being of magic like him, but more of an elemental force. Even the Spectre would have difficulty beating his shadows. Shade asks Fate to take off his helmet and talk to him as Kent Nelson. He knows of his origins, knows that Nabu the Wise influences and sometimes takes over the body and mind of Nelson, much to the chagrin of his long-suffering wife, Enza. Nelson assures Shade that he is in charge at the moment, and Enza is off elsewhere. And then Fate finally gets down to brass tacks.
A cult named the Wise Fools has moved into Salem nearby. They brought in a mystic named Remy Deshard from the Caribbean to transform some of the cult into an elite guard. They brought in another mage, whose goal is to give powers like the Shades to another group of their cult. To do so, they have constructed a radio tower, legal permits and all, which will slowly suck the ectoplasmic energies from hundreds of listeners who will be none the wiser.
The usually unflappable Shade is dismayed to realize who must be behind this. Culp, the man he thought died 100 years ago. Fate warns that the broadcasts have been going on for days. The shadow energy cannot be destroyed, but he may be able to contain it. He needs the Shade to use his shadows against theirs to get inside. Shade agrees, but demands that Culp is his to take care of. The two leap through Fate's portal and arrive in the woods outside of the radio tower. Around the tower's base stand armed men with the heads of owls.
Weird.
Yeah. As I stated a while back, I had no idea the story existed until we started this series. I can't remember if a listener clued me in or not. If you did, many, many thanks. I don't know if it was just me doing research or somebody mentioned it, but and if you did mention it, let me know, because I'm horrible about that. It seems odd that this story, which is much more important to the Shade's character than many other times past, was relegated to another series like Showcase.
Right.
It's really strange. Robinson is trying to rectify the Shade's published history with his own take on the character. He'll do that many times, but I really like the idea that the Shade was just playing with the Flashes out of sport and to cover up what he was really after.
Mm-hmm.
He even talks about working on his villain monologue so he won't bust out laughing while doing it.
Hey, and that gives you a reason why the dialogue was so bad. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like, whew.
I've always loved Dr. Fate, the original especially. To me, he was the most accessible of DC's big magic characters. You know, sorry, Ryan, but Zatanna was portrayed as too down-to-earth for me to group her in with Fate, Spectre, and Phantom Stranger. So when Kenner made a Dr. Fate figure, I was, like, on cloud nine. I just knew the rest of the JSA must be coming.
Not so much.
Yeah, not so much. Never happened. But anyway. Now, I do think Robinson may be indulging himself a bit too much by saying the Spectre would have a hard time defeating the Shade's powers. I mean, come on, the Spectre. Have you read Crisis on Infinite Earths?
Right.
I mean, come on. Come on, James. I mean, come on. I know you love the Shade, but this is the Spectre. Now, Robinson gives new readers a lesson in classic Fate 101 by having the Shade show that he collects facts and knows all about Kent Nelson's alter ego. You have to remember DC had been publishing that awful Fate series where the helmet was turned into a knife, and all that crud. It also spun out of Zero Hour, just like Starman. They gave that version two series before realizing no one wanted that. I mean, they canceled one book and gave them another. It's like, really? Okay. I normally don't spoil ahead here, but I'll just say this. When I read the name Culp, my jaw dropped. I had no idea he figured into things this early.
Mm-hmm.
I think this story must be his only mention until much later in the Starman series. Again, why is this story in Showcase?
Right.
And not Starman?
I mean, it's relatively short, so, you know, they could have just stuck it in there.
Yeah. There's no date given for this story, but it must be during the Silver or Bronze Age because you've got Jay and Barry working together.
Right, right.
So, well, you want to jump into the next part? You got anything more on that one?
No.
Okay. Showcase 96 number 5 was cover dated June 1996, on sale April 4th, 1996. This time, Green Arrow, Connor Hawk, and the Thorn are the spotlight on the cover by Mike Zeck. It's nice, but it's not important to us, so... Day and Night, Night and Bright Part 2 was by the same creative team.
Before continuing his story, Shade recaps what has transpired so far. He specifically mentions Culp, who was there when Shade gained his powers, and how he wants his head in his hands and his body elsewhere.
As the Tower's talk radio broadcasts fill the air, Shade and Fate make quick work of the owl-headed elite guard.
Not so elite.
Yeah. The remaining men retreat inside. Shade notes that he could easily slip into the compound with his powers, but he prefers something with more panache. Fate obliges and literally blows the doors off the building. Shade then contemplates just how he wishes to attack with the shadow powers, much to Fate's consternation. Shade's immediate concern is Culp. He questions one of the owl men, who tells him Culp had already left for fear of Shade's arrival.
Shade demands to know who the master is of the shadow creature they have created. The owl man informs him that Culp didn't say anything about needing a master. Now the Shade is worried. He rushes off to face the creature while Fate prepares his containment spell.
Shade pits his shadow against the masterless monster and chastises the Culp members for daring to harness it without a conduit. Fate casts his spell, and in a flash of light, the creature is gone. Though he has moved it to a different plane of existence, Fate warns it is still growing, with no master to control it. Fate commends the Shade spirit, despite his villainy. The man in black laments that he didn't get Culp, but then remarks the two of them have forever to meet again.
I can't help it. Whenever I see the words ectoplasm, I instantly think of Slimer from Ghostbusters. Every time. I can't help it. I see that, and I'm just like, I just keep thinking to see this little green blob going through.
He slimed me, Ray.
Yeah.
The radio broadcasts continue throughout the story until the demon is contained. I mean, they're little balloons that pop up.
I didn't like that.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, because to me, I had to go back and I had to read the radio portion of it.
Yeah.
And then go back and read the story part of it, because I kept getting, wait, is that part, you know?
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Now, some of them are kind of funny, such as a caller asking the talk radio host to settle a bet about the story order of the Clint Eastwood Man with No Name trilogy. And some are disturbing, such as a child calling in about parental sexual abuse, which, you know. So it just shows the different topics as they're going through. I really like the setup for this one, but the art really lets the story down in the final chapter. Matt Smith drew Starman 11, A Time's Past About Ragdoll, as you might remember. We commented that his art was very Mike Mignola-like then.
Uh-huh.
Here in this supernatural Hellboy-like setting, it's even more so. But I hate to be mean, but it's kind of like a poor man's Mike Mignola.
Right.
You know. The bad part is the over-stylized art just doesn't show us much of anything. It seems that the Shade is just standing around while Fate is randomly blasting mystical energy at something. What? We don't know. The panels are too tight.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, my comment was, and I hate to be this way, but to me, it was so vague because the artist themselves couldn't think of something to draw.
Right, it's like they couldn't interpret. It's almost like he couldn't interpret what Robinson asked him to draw.
Right.
Yeah, like you said. The art is murky and shadowy throughout, so when the Shade confronts the shadow demon, We can really only assume that's what's going on due to the little dialogue that Robinson gives us. What should have been a kapow moment is just a small panel of light.
I mean, it's teeny tiny. It's like, a 12th of the page?
Yeah.
Maybe?
And on the next page, it's just over.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now, despite all that, I'm glad I read this story because I love Dr. Fate, and I was, again, gobsmacked by Culp's involvement here. I'm now interested to reread the rest of the series and see how this fits into the grand narrative. But, yeah, the art, yeah. I don't think this art is unsuited to the story.
No.
The stylized heavy blacks work with the tone, but Smith really did a poor job with the storytelling at the end.
Which is what we talked about.
Yeah. So, but again, thanks to Rob for hooking us up with that. So now we will jump into Starman number 19, cover dated June 1996, on sale April 4th, 1996. The cover painting depicts a ghost pirate ship with three undead crewmen. In the foreground at the wheel is David Knight, dressed in red, yellow, and green period garb, and his brother Jack with a spyglass in his hands. Everything but David and Jack's goggle lenses are painted in gray tones. Talking with David, 96, Robinson, Harris, Von Graubadger, Wright, Oakley, NJQ, Goodwin, and Kim do the same things they did earlier.
Okay. On a gray-toned beach, Jack Knight, dressed in ragged clothes, waves a white flag. A small boat comes ashore to receive him and heads back out to sea. The bearded sailor rowing the boat remains silent while Jack blabs about. He comments that he had been on the island for a long time, or at least seemed to be. He asks his silent savior an odd question. Has he seen a brightly garbed superhero around? Having experienced this strange black and white world before, Jack just knows his dead brother David must be around somewhere.
The silent pirate then turns into David, clad in the classic red, green, and yellow of Starman. The two brothers embrace as their tiny boat pulls along a storybook pirate ship, complete with Jolly Roger flag. Despite the setting, David admits they're in the same place they met last time, although he can't say where that is. He does tell him the pirate theme is to give him a better understanding of that life, although again, he won't say why. When Jack asks why such a wacky setting, David says he was just feeling wacky. They both agree, David never felt like that in life.
As David asks his little brother about the years since they last met, Jack's clothes change from rags to proper pirate attire. Jack tells David about finding Michael and bringing him home to their father. He also tells him how he did the same thing with Solomon Grundy. David remembers that Grundy killed Ted's friend, Sylvester Pemberton. Jack admits he didn't know that, and that he must ask his father about it when he returns to the real world.
After making a few cracks about Jade, who sent Jack after Grundy, the boys discuss Jack's run-in with Nash, aka the Miss Two. Jack details how their dad took out Dr. Phosphorus. David is concerned when he hears Phosphorus burn Ted, but Jack assures him the Elder Knight had the wound checked out and is in good shape. Jack circles back to the mist and tells David he wants to prove her wrong about them. They are not alike, and that they aren't just playing parts in some sick pantomime.
David then points out an approaching ship. David tells his brother they are going to take that ship. Jack wonders how with just the two of them. David waves his hand, and suddenly his costume changes to pirate captain's garb in Starman colors. He yells to the empty sails, calling his non-existent crew to action. Jack just looks dismissively at his hammy brother, and then a skeletal pirate crew appears from nowhere to answer, "Aye!" to his brother's orders.
The next few pages are silent, save for an old sea shanty, as David, Jack, and the dead pirates raid the enemy ship. Swords flash, musket balls fire, and good old-fashioned pillaging ensues. The ship properly ransacked, they leave its carcass floating in flames. Back on their own ship, Jack admits he had fun, so long as no one was killed. But he wonders, what was all this about?
All David can tell him is that it will be important to understand the pirate life for Jack at some point. He points out that they were approaching Opal's Wharf, although it wasn't called Opal City back then. David knows of someone there who wants to meet Jack. He points out that today is Jack's birthday, although, as usual, he's forgotten.
Jack looks to the docks and is shocked and elated to see his mom waving back at him. As a tearful and overjoyed Jack runs from the ship to his long-lost mother, his brother tells him he only has about an hour. Jack thanks his brother profusely. David replies, "Anytime, bro, anytime." So how can you not love this cover?
Oh, it's awesome.
Who doesn't love ghost pirates? I never, before, you know, looking at this for this, the show, I never noticed that Jack's goggles are in color.
Yeah.
That's kind of strange that they are, but because they usually, David's the only thing that's in color.
Yeah.
But it's still cool. Maybe it's the black and white art, but you can really see how Harris's art style has evolved and improved since the series began. It's, of course, very stylized, but there is a realism to it. It's a livelier realism than true photorealism can give you. And his expressions are on par with artists like Kevin Maguire, who did the Captain America miniseries.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's an aspect of his art that is often overlooked, but he does some of the best, like, smirking and smug. I mean, it's not just smile, grimace. It's,
right.
He does all the in-between facial tics that people have, which I just think's awesome. David mentioned he was trying the Strasburg method of acting while playing the silent pirate. Jack comments Marlon and Monty would be proud. That's Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift.
Yeah.
So, like the previous Talking with David issue, there's not a lot to discuss about this, really. It's a great recap. The playful banter between the brothers is fantastic, and it's foreshadowing many things to come, months and years down the line in many cases. Very little is frivolous, but it kind of is what it is. You really have to read it.
Right.
You really have to read the comic to, we really can't do it justice. I know Ghost Skeleton Pirates existed before, but this was way before the Pirates of the Caribbean movie franchise, so pirates weren't popular at this time.
Right.
This was definitely during a downtime for pirates, so. I wonder if that sea shanty, that old song, is real or just made up by Robinson. I tried to find stuff online about it, and the only thing I could find was people basically just, scans of it and, talking about the issue. No, there was no credits for it, and that nobody, labeled, said this came from this source or.
But so many of those sea shanties wouldn't have an author. They were just something that was passed along and developed.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't expecting to find an author. I was just expecting to find whether it was one that was handed down.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So, but it's neat to read it and watch the panels. It really gives, this is a real good showcase for Harris.
Uh-huh.
Just art to cut loose. And he was probably just freaking out getting to draw, because he was, the name of his studio, along with other artists, I think Brian Stelfreeze that painted Batman covers and now he's drawing the new Black Panther. I think he was part of it. They were called the Jolly Rogers Studio.
Oh, that's cool. So that must have been something he loved anyway.
Yeah, he was into pirates anyway. So, I mean, and who knows, maybe Robinson partially tailored all the Black Pirate and this stuff to, which obviously this is going to, no, that you don't have to be a genius to figure out this is going to tie into the Black Pirate.
Right, it was just in, two issues back?
Yeah.
And we just talked about.
Right,
yeah.
So the ending of this issue gets to me hard.
I know it does.
As someone who lost her mom, 15 years ago, I can only imagine how Jack felt when he saw her waving back at him. I mean, short of you and the kids, I'd give about anything to just get an hour with my mom again. So, when I first read this, when it came out, my mom was still with us, so it didn't hit me like that then. But every time I pulled this one out and looked at it again, it's just like, oh, God, it kicks me right in the gut. So,
I know.
Anyway, there's a shade journal at the end of this that is just nearly illegible. The text is so damn tiny, I thought I needed Ted Knight's giant telescope to read it. If you can read it, it's a great character study of the shade, but it tells us.
I can't help it. I hate reading them. I mean, I just.
And they put it on that brown paper,
yes.
And it's just. I had to, go get underneath a lamp and, stare. And I have bifocals, people, and I had to, stare at it to be able to, right underneath my nose to be able to read it. It tells us the same thing as the last journal, only in minute detail, and that matches the font size. Shade contemplates killing a boorish acquaintance named Spencer Klein, who dared invite himself to join, quote-unquote, Mr. Black,
yeah,
for coffee. The two are roughly approached by armed men, and the Shade kills all but two. The leader, Sam Mild, then tells him he is working for Howard Hughes and offers to pay him for his services. Mild has been instructed to leave no witnesses, and the Shade is not a bit affected when Mild's last man murders Klein in cold blood. He's more interested in the weather out in Hollywood. So this shows that the Shade has changed quite a bit from, this guy was just annoying. He didn't do anything really to deserve to be killed, but according to the Shade, he did. So that's pretty much it, and I'm sure we'll follow that along into the next issue. So. So there you go. That was the Starman Chronicles Part 5. Again, a nice little snapshot of the series.
Right.
You got Talking with David, A Time's Past, several Shades journals, and, you know, really two times past because of the Shade Dr. Fate.
Well, yeah.
So there you go. Well, that'll do it for now. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. And is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders, and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com.
Comments can be left at supermatescomic.blogspot.com or by visiting fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FW Podcast.
Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
Somewhere along the way I found the meaning. Woke up dreaming along the way. Never quite seems the same when you awake. And making up for the time is such a price to pay. And then they take the dream away, and it just ain't fair. So help me through the night, Mama. Help me to ease the pain. Tell me it's all right. Help me through the night once again. Tell me.